All right, welcome back, everybody. A scintillating topic at hand for you guys here this week. I am ready to dive right in. We are here today to talk about murder. Dom, one of your favorites, right?
I love it. Can't get enough of a good murder.
Yes. Well, I guess not actually even necessarily murder, although I would say murder occupies a large percentage of this space. We're more accurately, I guess, here to talk today about true crime, Dom, a genre that I feel like has had a big come up over the last at least 5-10 years, and certainly existed long before that. But it feels to me, and maybe this is not accurate at all, but as every time I log into Netflix or check out the top podcasts on various platforms, or the top streaming like movie documentaries, so much of it, it feels like, has become true crime. Am I completely fabricating this here, Dom, or is this something that is actually happening?
I think you're completely right, and I couldn't trace the exact timeline or lineage of this. I don't know if 10 years ago, how far along that trajectory all of this would have been, but it really does feel like this is mass culture now. You know, this is almost the thing that you have to be on top of for the sake of, I guess, water cooler talk in years past, or you know, Zoom awkward banter before the meeting starts in years present. But this is now the thing, which, like, if you meet, depending on the social circles you run in, of course, and I know age and gender and everything factors into this too, but depending on the circles you run in, this is like the big talking point. This is the thing you bond over. This is, you know, you can assume that someone in your age group or demographic listens to true crime podcasts. They avidly consume true crime documentaries and series on Netflix. And it's just, it's this thing now, which it almost reminds me of how when things like Star Wars really just rocketed into the mainstream, and the idea of that being...
It reminds you back of when you were alive in 1977 or whatever.
I was around for one set of prequels and or sequels, so get off my ass. But it's, you know, there was a time when stuff like that could comfortably be relegated to the status of, you know, niche culture or like nerd culture, and then it became such a mass culture phenomenon that you really couldn't safely apply that label to it anymore. And it's like, you know, being into Game of Thrones now doesn't make you a nerd. It doesn't make you, put you into any kind of particular bucket or category. You are just someone who watches TV from time to time, right? And I feel like that's the status that true crime is rapidly acquiring, if not acquired years ago already, where it feels like it's really not any kind of mark of interest or personality now if someone is obsessed with true crime. It's the kind of thing where, you know, on someone's dating profile they'll say, well, they love traveling and they love dogs and they love The Office and of course they love true crime. It's so anodyne now that it's not it's not as controversial as this kind of topic really maybe should be. I guess we can get into that.
So I recognize I probably shouldn't be coming into this podcast asking with no real basis statistically about like the increased popularity in true crime. It appears I would not make the best kind of true crime investigator if I'm putting in that kind of effort on the note taking here. But I, as far as the like origins of the blow up, first and foremost, I do feel like it is worth, since I don't know when else this is going to come up, it, as far as I've been able to discern as a, certainly not a novice, I have put in plenty of hours watching true crime, but as a big time casual true crime fan and not someone who by any stretch wants to make it seem like I know the whole history of the genre here, I feel like Errol Morris, The Thin Blue Line, is, from what I can tell, again, kind of widely regarded as the OG that got people talking about this in a mainstream way, but that was back in like 1984. And then I feel like that's the one that always stands out when you pull up the list of like the 25 best true crime documentaries you can stream right now. Most of them are from much more recent years. And then there's that one from 1984 that always makes the cut as well. But if I were to try to pinpoint when true crime started becoming a major piece of the water cooler talk, so to speak. Not that I was around any literal water coolers for any meaningful length of time. I actually feel like it may not be a TV show or docuseries or documentary film. I think it might have been Serial, season one, the podcast covering the Adnan Syed story that really not only put true crime kind of into the modern zeitgeist, if I'm using that correctly, but also I think kind of put podcasts onto the cultural map. I will go with a safer word there.
I think that's very fair to say. And if you are constructing the history of how all of this came about, I think Serial is going to be a big part of it. And I do think there's something to this idea that the podcast Serial, and both parts of that are important. It's not just that it's a podcast, and it's not just about the fact that it's about what it was about, but the fact that it's that medium as a way of kind of delivering that and bringing that to a mass audience. I think there were definitely a lot of people out there for whom that was kind of their entree into both podcasts and true crime, and they now could, you would have to pry either of those from their cold dead hands to get them to go away from those for any length of time. So I do think that is a big step for sure. The Thin Blue Line is an interesting example to bring up, because I feel like that was a piece of media which was, for lack of a better word, important. You know, it's covering a real life event which displays, you know, some of the shocking, you know, flaws, inadequacies, some by accident, many by design, at the heart of the criminal justice system. And the film itself was, you know, very widely acclaimed, but also criticized in some quarters. And it kind of experimented with a new format for conveying all of this stuff. And, you know, this was, from what I'm seeing here, the first documentary film to really use reenactments to that degree, and that kind of crossed the line for some segments of the audience. So that is,
what was the width and color of that line that it crossed?
Tough to say, you know, but that I think is an important step forward in the history of the medium, the topic, and so on and so forth. That feels like it's qualitatively different from the vast majority of true crime content out there today, which has this almost voyeuristic tone to it, where, like, if it came down to it and I was being, you know, bludgeoned to death by some like crazed psychotic axe murderer, at the back of my mind, you know, after many other things, would be the thought, I know that some like giggly British lady is going to open a podcast by saying, oh, we got some lovely murders for you today, before dissecting all of the gory details of my death. And it does, I don't know if it cheapens it, or if it feels like we collectively as a society are very desensitized to the kind of gravity of the subject matter. And that's almost the point. It's, you get into it because it is, you know, titillating, it's subversive in a way, it feels dangerous, there's this air of kind of mystery about it. But then once it becomes so ubiquitous, and once the format becomes so formulaic, and this is the kind of thing which you can safely discuss with just random strangers you meet on the street, and it's, in some places, it's almost kind of weird if you're not into this. At that point, it feels like it loses those qualities which, in theory, should have drawn people to it in the first place. Like, this is now, as I said, just like saying you watch The Office. It feels like mm-hmm. It has the same kind of stakes.
Yeah, and to quickly go back, I only brought up the Thin Blue Line just to make it clear to people who may think that I'm about to be focusing so much on more recent things, because I think Sarah Koenig invented true crime in 2010 or whatever, which is definitely not the case.
She did that, Colin.
Yeah, but I want to dive a little further into what you were just getting at there at the end, which was, what is making true crime so popular? And in kind of thinking through why it might be in preparation for this podcast, I do agree with what you were just saying, which is, it's something people have always, I think, inherently, instinctively, whatever word is correct in this context, been interested in and just never had the access to until Netflix came along and the algorithm showed that people were just gobbling up tons of true crime. And so they kept making more and more and more. I would guess that is a major piece of what is going into this. But I also think the potentially most vital piece of what's going into true crime being so popular is the fact that it's true. You know, drama and fictional murders have always been a cornerstone of any kind of storytelling medium. But I think the knowledge that everyone has when they're watching it of this is something that is actually going on out there in the real world every single day. And it's thankfully to this point, at least, not affecting me and not affecting for the most part, anyone that I know or love. And I can kind of compartmentalize it as I'm just a TV viewer watching this story being told. At the same time, I think the knowledge that it is a real thing that happened to someone and will continue happening to people all the time makes it that much more tantalizing and hooks us that much more as viewers.
One theory I've heard for why there's so much interest in true crime in particular, and we can get on to the crucial, I guess one of the crucial differences is fairly straightforward here, but the differences between, you know, true crime and fictional crime. I think one thing that plays into its popularity is almost the opposite of that in a way. It's that when you live in a world where you turn on the news every night and there's always some story about some incredibly gory murder that's happened or some terrible thing that's out there in the world, someone's gone missing, someone's turned up dead, and if you, like many people our age or slightly older, if you grew up in this climate of you have to be deathly afraid of strangers, your parents wouldn't let you talk to anyone unless they were clearly vetted first, and there was this very sharp distinction between authority figures who you had to place this implicit trust in and stranger danger, where anyone could be the boogeyman lurking under the bed, even though, as we know, the vast majority of most forms of crime happens between people who know each other, and that trust often is what greases the wheels for that and opens the door for that to be possible in the first place. I think once the dividing lines are drawn in that way, it's almost comforting to claim ownership of the fact that there is so much malice and tragedy out there in the world by sensationalizing it, by turning it into this consumable product, which you can sit back and enjoy and digest. And you're turning it from something which in theory could happen to you at any time, whenever you go outside, and you're making it into something which is you kind of engage with at your own pace, where you put on a podcast as you go to work and you hear about the salacious, gory details of someone's grisly death, and then you get to work and you turn it off and you go about your day and you don't think about it anymore outside of that narrow interstitial time frame, right? And I feel like that's actually an essential part of what makes this so popular, because you can get to it via the route of some part of my personality just loves this stuff and wants to devour it as much as possible, but I think you can also get to it from the route of I am someone who naturally is naturally, temperamentally, via social conditioning, whatever, is very scared of the possibility of stuff like this, and this is how I cope with that. This is my form of therapizing that, almost.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that. I guess what I'm just kind of getting at is the idea that truth, number one, I guess, a couple of things here. Number one, truth is often stranger than fiction, and that, I think, plays very nicely into why true crime is so appealing, because the viewers know that all of these twists and turns and all of these decisions being made by whatever parties are involved, obviously bearing in mind there's going to be some editorial creative licensing, or that's the wrong term, editorial creative, what am I going for, Dom, here, please save me.
No idea. Could not help you even if I wanted to.
All right. Artistic liberties. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. There it is. Artistic liberties being taken with the edit. I think the just mere knowledge that the twists and turns are not being written by some author who had infinite time to map out the most compelling story possible, and these are true events, is interesting, number one. But I also do want to double back on the idea that, I think virtually anyone, if shown a loop, a YouTube video of 30 straight minutes of car crashes from movies that they know are fictional or TV shows or whatever, versus 30 straight minutes of dash cam footage of car accidents that are actually happening in real life, or did happen, I guess, in real life, I think pretty much anyone would be more emotionally invested in the one that they know actually happened there. And furthermore, I certainly don't want to compare them to superheroes, because that is not what I'm getting at all. But I do think there is something about people who are literally capable of murder that watching them as a human incapable of murder makes, much like a superhero would, makes them stand out from the pack so much that in the opposite way from a superhero. Let me just make it very clear that serial killers are not superheroes. But while superheroes are so infinitely... All right, I hope that it's clear roughly what I'm getting at with that.
That is one fascinating aspect of all of this, I think, that for many people, these serial killers, that maybe they are not explicitly hailed as superheroes, but they do achieve this cult-like status almost, and they become these objects of sincere fascination, if not admiration. And you know, it's always been a trend of you hear about these serial killers who are being, you know, they have sacks of mail sent to them in prison by people wanting to be their pen pals, wanting to get married to them, or who they want to be their friend, or that they want to or their confidant, or there's some weird, very strange parasocial relationship going on.
Charles Manson had like 7 kids from jail.
It's astonishing. Yeah. And in many cases, you hear about these supervillains, I think it's fair to call them that, having this extraordinary charisma or hold over people, or this amazing ability to manipulate. And that's how they are able to get not just romantic partners, friends, admirers, many of them have people just like sending them money as well. But this is a skill set which has allowed them to just wreak havoc on whatever area, field of interest, or whatever they put themselves into. But in many cases, it's almost the fact that they are a serial killer, absent any specific personality traits or anything else, that in itself becomes something which draws people in and draws people to them. And that is, I would say, certainly a sign of concern, you know, and I feel like that can only be more acute in this day and age, where for any given serial killer or any case that achieves particular notoriety, the details of that are going to reach an order of magnitude more people than they ever had before. And often it gets featured on one podcast, one documentary, and then that blows up, or there's some there are some like online sleuths that devote themselves to unpacking every detail of this and figuring it out, and often there are some innocent casualties of that if people are wrongly implicated, or you it has to feel so strange on the receiving end if you are a survivor of this kind of violent crime, in the sense that it happened to someone you love, and that's years in the past, you've been trying to heal those wounds over time, and then suddenly it gets this new wave of media attention, of individual attention, and those wounds are being torn open yet again.
Totally, yeah. And supervillain, coming up with that word would have saved me a lot of time in my previous statement there. So let's go with
I was
that.
I was just saving it for my own remarks. So,
thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. Let me, before I forget to ask, is true crime, as far as you know, also blowing up in England?
Yes, like all other universally popular cultural phenomena across the Western world, it is blowing up in England. And some might even say, Colin, that we are responsible for some of that. You know, going back, this is something that we are known for, from, you know, Agatha Christie, famously, to, you know,
famous true crime documentary maker, well, Agatha Christie.
Okay. Listen. Don't. I know what you're trying to do here, but the idea of like
Jack the Ripper.
Right. I mean, you know, we have our fair share of high profile maniac psychopaths, so on and so forth. Rose and Fred West, Myra Hindley. There are so many cases. James Bulger, the murder of him. So many cases which, if you are, you know, someone who was born in the 70s, 80s, 90s, you grew up hearing about these stories constantly. And there was certainly a mainstream media fascination with true crime, even if that hadn't percolated into the cultural mainstream yet. But also, I think there is this pipeline of sorts between fictional crime and true crime, but I almost think it's more curious when that's exclusive, where there are people who are interested in fictional crime. And I know when I was growing up, my mom loved any kind of crime fiction. And when I was, you know, 13, 14, I was reading these incredibly dark, gory crime novels by this British crime author, Val McDermid, who...
Hang on, can I get that name one more time?
Val McDermid.
Okay. not as cartoonish as I was hoping for a British person.
Oh, see, I thought you were just wanting to check out her wares, and you were just getting the name there to, yeah, to run okay. off
I'm
going to
head to the library right now, Dom.
Yeah. But I was reading these, like, very PG-18-plus crime novels, which, you know, I don't know what kind of effect that had on my childhood psyche growing up, but I'm sure it was not a good one. But she loved crime novels, any kind of crime fiction and stuff like that. But as far as I could tell, she really never expressed an interest in true crime of any sort. And I have to imagine that goes the opposite way, too. Maybe some of this new wave of people who got into true crime recently and now they don't want to consume basically anything else, maybe don't have as much interest in works of fiction. I would be interested to hear if there's been research done on exactly what it is that kind of shuts off you know, whichever one you're interested in, what shuts the other one off to you.
I had never done the math on that or asked any questions of myself, but now that that point has been brought to my attention, my mind is reeling about the impact that reality TV may have had on my life, or various podcasts that I've gotten into along the way, and documentary movies. Like, I pretty much have never read books since getting into reality TV, and very, very infrequently watched mainstream movies or even non-mainstream movies, as opposed to the vast majority, I would say, of actual feature-length-ish movies that I watch are not necessarily true crime, but documentaries of about one topic or another. And it had never even registered with me, Dom, that just making the transition into these are real people telling actual stories that either happened to them or went on around them or they investigated them versus just kind of being out on fiction in general is something I'd never even considered. So this has been an eye-opening podcast for me, no matter what happens here.
One thing that did occur to me when we were brainstorming which topics to do and we came up with this was I'm surprised that we haven't seen any large-scale moral panic over true crime yet, really, where suddenly when we were growing up, there was our parents were deluged by these fears among mainstream commentators, politicians, religious figures, and so on, that video games were going to rot their children's brains and turn them all into these, you know, at best zombies, at worst evil murderers. And when you think about what a medium can do to kind of glorify or desensitize you to a certain kind of behavior, it feels like what we're seeing with true crime, if anything, has to be up there with that kind of a potential psychological impact. Now, as far as I can tell, there's never been any like real substantive proof that video games can do that to you. I doubt there's going to emerge anything that, you know, there is a reliable path from you listen to My Favorite Murder and then you actually go on to murder someone. But I am surprised that, like, that lack of evidence never stopped those fears from taking hold in the first place. And so I'm kind of surprised that this isn't being held up more as a sign of the, you know, the moral degradation of society by the people who like to whittle on about that sort of thing.
I do think that is a fair point. And I now wonder whether My Favorite Murder or just the sound of my voice has led more podcast listeners to have murderous thoughts along the way. But I actually just also want to quickly clarify, I'm now wondering if my theory holds a lot of weight, considering the amount of prestige drama television that I do watch from my past point. So again, not sure what kind of investigator I would be making here myself.
I feel like my dulcet tones have inspired murderous rages in you fairly often. So I don't know if there's any research to be done on that account. But maybe that's why this dynamic works, is you get the people going, to borrow a phrase. And I'm the one who's mellifluous British voice. It's like the shipping forecast. It just calms you down, sends you to sleep. And maybe that's why so many British people are hosting true crime podcasts nowadays. But it's just the vibe that it gives off makes it kind of more soothing, which I guess it kind of has to be given the subject matter.
We are definitely playing a very elaborate and deliberate, I'm going to say, game of good podcaster, bad podcaster in far more ways than one here. and I don't love which side of that equation I'm on, but got to stick with it for the bit. Dom, do you feel like true crime has a bubble? Because as far as I can tell, Netflix is not slowing down anytime soon here. And as more and more kind of major corporations start their own streaming platforms, I do genuinely wonder if a bigger and bigger percentage of Netflix original content is just going to keep being true crime to such an extent that they maybe, like, far in the future are largely not dependent on, but like that's their main thing, which maybe we're already at that point. The question I'm getting at though is I certainly don't think this is a fad or a craze or whatever. I think this is something that has been established as people are very into this and presumably will be for a long time. But do you feel like there's something that could come along that could outdo true crime, or is murder about as scintillating as it gets for humans, and this is the peak for a while?
I'm open to the idea that something, some new craze could come along and steal the attention that the true crime has at the moment. But I don't think the interest in true crime is going to diminish organically. And one big reason for that, and it's a very depressing reason, is it's not like there's any lack of source material. And it's not like the pool of source material for true crime is limited in any way. So there will always be new cases for people to sink their teeth into, for the vultures to circle around and descend upon. And there's never going to be any shortage of that. So even if you restricted the scope of whatever new true crime feature you're working on to cases from the past year or the past however many years, you're never going to run out of good material. And that's just a depressing fact about the world that we live in. So in that sense, when there's always this constantly refreshing well of source material to draw upon, and also, as you say, this activates the most primal instincts in so many people in terms of fear, excitement, and so on and so forth, it's really hard to see how this is a bubble that could burst. I think this is a reliable formula for getting people engaged in content. It has been for thousands and thousands of years, since the dawn of time. This is what gets people going. It's, you activate that fight or flight response, you tell a compelling story, and it's more compelling in part because it's true, right? And this is, I think, the essential feature, where if there are so many details of the most gory, the most scary true crime cases, where if you wrote this into some crime novel that you were writing, you would write that off as, oh, that's a convenient plot development, or, oh, okay, this seems a little bit extreme, even given what we're talking about here, and even given the whatever characterization you've put into this. It's like the best stories are, you couldn't write them. And there are so many of those stories that you're going to see this time and time again, I think.
Yeah, I feel like it's here to stay, to put it mildly. And as I alluded to, I think murder may be such a hard bar for any other kind of topic to clear, at least anytime soon, based on the world as it currently exists in the year 2021, that, as I alluded to, it wouldn't surprise me if not necessarily Netflix, but some major streaming platform essentially just goes close to all in on true crime and potentially reaps some enormous rewards for doing so. Dom, I'm disappointed that neither of us has been able to rope the other one into giving an answer to a question that only the killer would know, and on this podcast discussing true crime, we can have kind of that big reveal at the end where one of us is actually now found guilty, and this is a viral sensation that HBO is going to come calling for soon. But with that, unfortunately, for the time being, still undone, let me ask about your take on a couple of specific true crimes that I'm hoping most people are familiar with. And I want to big time preface all of this discussion with, number one, I'm a complete idiot. Number two, Dom is not a complete idiot, but I think he's going to take some artistic liberties with some of his takes here. This is in no way intended as anything beyond entertainment purposes. We are not alleging anything. I just want to get Dom's views on what he thought. Please don't sue us, specifically Carol Baskin. Okay. Dom, let's start there, I guess. What did you think of Tiger King?
Well, I love Tiger King. And if you listen to my podcast about it with Kirsten McInnes, God, that's got to be... I think that was literally the first week of lockdown, right? Close to a year ago now, so... God, we're really dating this podcast more than any of us are going to be comfortable with. But I love Tiger King, and there are severe ethical concerns, not just about the content of Tiger King, but the content of Tiger King, the making of the documentary itself, the way that it treats many of its subjects, the way that it, you could argue, glorifies the abuse of animals, the way that it implicates certain people, lets other people off the hook, and so on. I didn't know if Carol Baskin killed her husband or not, but there's like now the kind of a counter backlash to Tiger King, where the idea that, well, how can we hate Carol for possibly potentially killing her husband when there are so many, where we view Joe Exotic and all of these other characters as, they're characters, right? Whereas Carol Baskin, like, she's a she-devil who, we have to live in mortal fear of. For me, Tiger King became this whole talking point in and of itself. For me, that is very different, where it is deliberately meant to be as sensational as humanly possible. And the fact that there is murder and all of this other stuff involved is essential to why it's so scandalous, but it's kind of incidental at the same time, right? Whereas for most true crime content, it's, okay, today we're here to talk about a murder on episode 167, and on episode 168, we'll come back in and we'll talk about another murder. Whereas Tiger King, it's almost like it's Mad Max, right? You just watch the carnage unfold. That is the entire point. This is meant to be you slam your foot on the gas pedal and you don't let up until the end of the seventh episode. Whereas both the tone and the subject matter of even the most gory, true crime content often is very different.
One thing I have never been able to wrap my mind around is Carol Baskin obviously had quite a spotlight shone upon her about a year ago right now. And as far as I remember hearing, at least in like the Joel McHale after show special or whatever, and whatever other Tiger King content I have consumed afterwards, is she was not happy at all with how that played out, and she didn't realize until very late in the game, if not like after it had started airing, that she was going to be portrayed that way. She probably got the gist when she kept being asked about what happened to her husband, but I get that initial reaction. What I don't get is, a few months ago, or however long ago it was, she then went on Dancing with the Stars after like having this big social media explosion where everyone's talking about her. It seems like nothing really comes of it. We kind of move on to some other stuff, and she's sneaking back into the shadows. And then she goes back on national TV. What are you doing, Carol Baskin?
I think she has realized that at this point, she is a media personality, she is a public figure, and therefore why not lean into that? If America at large is going to assume you're some like praying mantis who devoured your husband, then why not milk that for as many dollars as you can?
I mean, I guess it just is astounding to me that I mean, maybe trying to get inside the mind of Carol Baskin, or frankly any of these characters from Tiger King, is going to be an uphill battle for me, and I would imagine most other people. But I could not believe it when I saw that she was going to be on Dancing with the Stars there. Dom,
but
another...
But that I think, is crucial, that final point, where there is this understanding that Tiger King is a portal into a world which is so unlike anything, I hope, that any of us have any frame of reference for. It's a world of, you know, the exotic animal trade and hard drugs and murder and all of this other just completely absurd stuff. Whereas so much of, you know, you go on the Unsolved Mysteries subreddit, for example, you look at some of the top posts there, you look at the cases that get a lot of the most traction. The victims in many cases are ordinary people. It's, you know, it's college students. It's just people with kids who got murdered in their own homes. It's people who seem to be living ordinary lives in an ordinary way, and then suddenly it's cut short. They're just out of the blue by something that they couldn't anticipate. Whereas for as much as the characters in Tiger King are scary, and I don't want anything to do with most of them, I know that I'm not going to need to have anything to do with most of them. I can make a conscious choice to stay out of that universe altogether. Whereas I think a large chunk of mainstream true crime content trades on the fact that, in theory, this could be you, right? And in order to comfort yourself from that, then just huddle in close and listen to us laugh about it, and that'll make you feel better.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that distinction there. I think that is a good one to make. Dom, we also talked whenever it came out, and again, time very difficult to gauge these days, but a couple of years ago, at least at this point, Making a Murderer, the Stephen Avery case. We had it was Dom Abate and Chris Hammonds, I believe, on to talk about that. I'm not sure if there's even a follow-up planned there, but if you would, be interested in hearing our more detailed thoughts on that specific case, there is certainly at least one. But did we do multiple podcasts about that? I honestly don't remember, but that case is certainly very interesting as well, and on Netflix, in case anyone missed it.
And Making a Murderer has invited a lot of what you might call meta commentary about true crime as a medium, where for a lot of people, this is a blatant attempt to paint Stephen Avery in the most flattering light, you know, leaving out a lot of pertinent details about his history and his actions and behavior in this specific case. And so we should not think for a second that true crime either is or really can be most of the time this objective, dispassionate medium. You could argue that the mere fact of like fixing your gaze on some of these cases causes what you're looking at to be seen through this warped angle, where like there is a good reason that by and large you get trained detectives, trained crime scene investigators in to examine all of this, and they don't turn to amateur sleuths on the internet or true crime enthusiasts to dissect all the details of this for them. And so I think there is a certain level of responsibility, especially in the case of true crime, that maybe there isn't for your bog standard documentary about someone's life or someone's quest to become the best competitive gardener of all time or something. Like when you're talking about true crime, there is an ethical duty, a duty of care to your subject in general and the subjects of your documentary to handle that responsibly. And some true crime media does that well, some does it poorly, but that is something that you have to grapple with in a way that a lot of media simply doesn't have to.
I mean, I definitely agree that the bulk of people behind the cameras and in the editing room and so forth on true crime documentaries are not going out of their way by any stretch to like weave a web of lies or whatever. At the same time, pretty much every documentary in the history of documentary is going to have some sort of angle or agenda or whatever. And I'm now very mad at myself because I don't remember what the title of it was, because I just watched too much damn true crime. But there was some semi-recent docu-series that I want to say was on FX. And unfortunately, I can't remember the title right now. But Errol Morris was one of the people regularly being interviewed on it, because he had been following this case from like the 90s, back when it had happened and it had never been solved, and he had all of his own theories. And for the bulk of the episodes, I kept saying to myself, I mean, if Errol Morrison, again, this is the guy who directed and did a lot on The Thin Blue Line back in the day and kind of put, at least as far as I'm concerned, or as far as I know, this whole genre on the map in the first place. The spoiler alert, the docuseries literally ends with him giving a confessional, I guess I will call it, about just the almost impossibility of having reliable narrators along these sorts of lines, and that if he's ever given the impression that he's some kind of reliable narrator, that was entirely an accident. And I do think that is worth bearing in mind while also acknowledging, as you said, Dom, this is, I would guess, although again, obviously don't have hard data here, an area where the documentary filmmakers are going to be a lot more inclined on average to err on the side of giving a more accurate story than people covering other topics necessarily would, when they are largely going for fabricated sensationalism and manufactured drama that murder, thankfully, this is one of the great things murder has going for it, doesn't really need. That's already built in with the concept of murder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all right. What did you think? Did you watch The Staircase?
So I watched the first part of it years and years ago, and then I kept meaning to get round to completing it when I listened to Brent's episode on The Taran Show, where he talked about his indirect involvement in all of those events, but just never got around to actually finishing it. So add that one to the ever-growing list, I suppose.
Okay, I watched very quickly and enjoyed The Staircase. I don't honestly remember a ton of the details there, but...
So do you subscribe to the owl theory?
I think... I love, first of all, that the owl theory exists, and I'm certainly not saying the owl theory is a hard 0%, but even as a guy who is very routinely on podcasts talking about how variance is impossible to ignore and flukes happen all the time, and over a large enough sample size, crazy coincidences are absolutely guaranteed to go down, I do wonder... if there should have been a couple more questions asked when it was the second time that the wife has been found dead at the bottom of the dude's staircase. But
what is it they say, that like one is an accident, two is careless or something?
I don't know. And again, I'm already worried about saying anything, like lodging any theories too conclusively there. And from what I recall, actually, I think they did a pretty bad job prosecuting him, and maybe like from a legal standpoint, to overturn it or whatever was like technically justified or whatever, but I'm going to be staying away from Michael Peterson. That's how I will put that one. On the other hand though, Dom, to return to Serial season one, I feel like a lot of people came away thinking it would have been at the very least very difficult for Adnan to have actually done it. Were you on that sort of page, or do you have the Dom Harvey Edgelord of Extinction take on this one?
So I may have consumed different content about Serial than you did. The sense that I got from most people was they thought Adnan did it, and that Serial maybe left out some pertinent information, but that the podcast did a decent job of introducing some kind of reasonable-ish doubt. And you certainly can come away concluding, not to like split the difference, but that he probably did do it, but that the basis on which he was convicted was very lacking, and that there were some major procedural flaws that at the very least would merit a retrial, if nothing else.
I definitely will agree that is a very common takeaway, is even if he did do it, it seemed like quite a stretch to convict on whatever they had. I'm sorry, again, don't remember the details too well. And you could be totally right that there are far more people out there than I've been talking Serial with that are firmly of the belief that he did do it and should have been convicted, or whatever the case may be. I may just be in an Adnan echo chamber. At the same time, and I want to heavily emphasize, this is by no means a scientific metric. I have listened to all of Serial, the podcast. I watched the entirety of the HBO documentary, which was called The Case Against Adnan Syed, which I am going to submit as the single most misleading documentary title in the history of movies, or of docuseries, or whatever you want to call it. It is very much the case on behalf of Adnan Syed, just presented on TV instead of on a podcast. I thought I was going to watch a documentary about, like, this is everything Serial didn't show you, because they were going so hard at trying to make him look innocent. But I just want to complete that thought before I forget it. Given the amount of Adnan Syed just speaking that I have heard, I have never once gotten the sense that he is lying about what he said. Like, I know that this is not based on anything concrete whatsoever, but and I could be totally wrong about this. I know a lot of people feel like they're good at this sort of thing and are dead wrong, but I genuinely feel like I'm a pretty good reader of that sort of thing, and at no point ever have I gotten the sense that Adnan is trying to hide anything.
And that was part of the criticism of Serial initially, was people thought that Sarah Koenig really bought what Adnan was selling, was kind of taken in by his personal charm, and that fed through into her presentation of the case.
It could be happening exactly to me as well. That could be exactly what's happening.
But that's the thing, is a lot of criminals of whatever kind do have that charm. And you would almost, as dangerous and depressing as it sounds, you'd expect those qualities to be overrepresented in people who not successfully in Adnan's case, whatever he did or did not do. You would expect those character traits to be overrepresented in the criminal population compared to the population at large. Like, most people you meet, even if they really were harboring some deep personal grudge, would not really have the wherewithal or the charm or whatever to plot a murder, successfully execute it, and then be able to charm so many people into thinking that they didn't do it. You know, that is not within most people's range.
No, I agree with that. I just wanted to put it out there and probably be mostly mocked, because there's no real upside to saying that sort of thing, but I just have never gotten that vibe. And that should not obviously make one ounce of difference in a court of law or whatever. Just to me, that is something that I feel like I've been decent at picking up on over the course of my life. And when watching other kind of true crime things, I constantly am saying, all right, this guy's full of shit. But for whatever reason, and I could be completely getting played here, I just never once got that vibe from Adnan there. But Dom, I feel like we can at least finally start talking about someone.
I was going to say, I do enjoy the twists and turns that Serial has taken over its lifespan, where after that smash hit success of a first season, which I don't think anyone involved in it really suspected, obviously the question then becomes, when season two? What's season two going to be about? It turns out season two is some weird trip into the trials and tribulations, I guess literal trials, of Bo Bergdahl, this like army deserter who, and as far as I can tell, that season was universally panned. There was no real regard either for the choice of case for that season or for the way that they actually presented it. People thought, this is either boring or kind of weirdly dishonest. But then the third season dealt with a series of, it was basically looking at the justice system in Cleveland. So they spent a year at the major courthouse, just bearing witness to all of the proceedings there, seeing the cases kind of come through the door, get tried, and then following up with those people and so on. And that was truly fascinating and very professional, very well done. I would highly recommend anyone else listening to that. And then, as always is the case with these podcast networks, the Serial podcast feed then kind of got taken over by this other series from somewhere else in the network, talking about the public policy impact of the white parents have on inner city public schools. It really took some interesting turns along the way.
So I didn't know that they even did seasons beyond the Bo Bergdahl one. And I wonder what, like, the people, and this is not a tangent we need to spend a ton of time on, I wonder if they feel like they fumbled the bag there, or if they feel like, you know, this is the direction we always wanted to go, and whatever success we got out of the first season is fantastic, but we're not just trying to cater to the true crime demo.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'd be curious to hear if they feel like they dropped the ball there on, like, the everyone talking about their podcast constantly front, but I could see it definitely going the other way, so I definitely don't want to make any firm judgments there. Dom, one case I feel a bit more comfortable talking about in certain terms. Did you watch The Jinx?
I did, yes. And earlier on, when you talked about one of us ending the podcast with a big finish by revealing that we're responsible for something, that's what immediately came to mind for me, is I'm just like accidentally hot miking after we're all said and done, and I thought we've hung up, and I just confessed to some grisly murder.
I did a Twitch stream semi-recently, and for the first time, attempted to end the stream by raiding someone else's channel. I think it was Kirsten's channel. And did not know that after you press the raid button, you then also need to press the end stream button. And was like, got up and like went to the kitchen and got some water or whatever. And then just came back down and sat at my computer and was like watching her stream for a few minutes and had no idea that I was still like live and visible on my own stream. And thank God that I don't know how this is possible. I swear that like 7 minutes was like a 99.9th percentile of like least embarrassing 7 minutes of me sitting in front of my computer that I could possibly hope for. So really got away with my own kind of mini murder on that one there. But ever since then, the very first thing I do when I shut down a Twitch stream is immediately unplug my webcam. Just there's no chance of anything going on if this is unplugged there. But yeah, The Jinx is outstanding if anyone has missed that. And then I also wanted to quickly bring up one other thing, which is non-murder kind of true crimes. I actually feel like have a ton of potential as well. If they could get willing participants the way that they got, notably like Billy McFarlane with Firefest and those two documentaries to open up about things. And also another one that I know you were a big fan of as well, and I ended up watching it on your recommendation and really enjoyed it. I don't know how many people have seen it, but there is a wild story called The Imposter, which I would encourage people to Google and figure out where they can watch. I'm sorry, I probably should have done that for you and could tell you right now where you could go watch it. I believe I watched it on Amazon the first time around. And I feel like con artists coming clean could be a very intriguing subgenre of true crime if more of them are willing to come forward.
To me, this is I love mysteries. I'm a big mystery buff, and so that does have some spillover into true crime. And you know, often I will find myself for as much as I kind of poke fun at the genre here, I am not immune to this. I am not pretending that I'm better than any of you out there. I also will find myself just poring over the details of some Reddit case, of some case in a thread on Reddit, going down that rabbit hole. But to me, what really piques my interest is non-murder mysteries, and there is a subreddit to that effect. It's literally just r/non-murder mysteries, and to me, that's some of the more interesting and engaging stuff out there. And I guess the murder cases that interest me most are the ones that have this mystery component to them. So stuff like the Somerton Man, or I like the Jennifer Fegate case that I think was on what's the show? I'm blanking on the name here. The one that was on Netflix recently, which I guess is not narrowed down. help me out here. I know I didn't bail you out before, but
it was one of like each episode.
Unsolved Mysteries, of course. So
the one that was on Netflix recently. That is such a distinctly late 20s British person perspective on Unsolved Mysteries, which was a massively popular cable TV show network TV show potentially even throughout the 90s. It's so funny to, and I don't mean to shame you for presenting it that way because it totally makes sense, but it had never even occurred to me that people would have that as like their primary background on what Unsolved Mysteries is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, anyway, sorry. Yeah, continue on the Unsolved Mysteries point.
Well, I was just saying that episodes like that, you know, I watched a decent amount of the most recent season, and the episodes that really stuck with me, I guess unresolved or unsolved mysteries, they always are presented in a way where there's some missing link, there's some element of suspense to it. But I like the ones where they just seem bizarre more so than anything else, where, you know, someone dies from inside a locked hotel room, but there's no plausible way they could have done it, or that there are signs of, you know, a struggle or something, but then there's no possible way the person could have got in or out without leaving some trace of themselves. Stuff like that, where there's some just some riddle, some piece that doesn't quite add up. Like that's what really does it for me, as opposed to, oh, someone goes missing and a decomposed body is found in a ditch 5 days later. Like that kind of generic murder mystery case is not my thing.
I definitely agree with that. I think that is a good distinction. And I also want to clarify, I'm now very self-conscious about that tendency that I have. And I would say it's probably similar with like your accent as well. And I noticed this when I was recently editing the Hamilton episode, talking about the Tumblr I would like to see of all of the people erroneously thinking they're citing Hamilton lyrics when it's like Nas from like 1994 or whatever. I want to be very clear. I am by no means shaming people for having those kind. I understand contextually they were not there in 1994. Dom was not here in 1994 to know what unsolved mysteries was. And I myself fall victim to that exact same thing all the time. And I definitely did not in the Hamilton podcast or in this moment mean for it to come across any differently. I think it's just the mere fact that it stands out is interesting to me, but I was horrified about how that sounded in both cases.
Apology not accepted. I will be nursing this grudge for the foreseeable future.
Yes. One other show that I wanted to give a quick shout out to here, Dom, is another one of the OGs here, and they ended up doing hundreds upon hundreds of episodes, all of which come with some sort of murder related specific to this case kind of pun title, which, you know, I'm a big fan of Forensic Files, which I believe is available on Netflix, has done a lot of good in helping me fall asleep at night. That narrator voice talking over all of these various cases that are laid out and neatly solved in 22 minutes as ominous music plays in the background is elite. It certainly looks and feels very dated by modern standards, but anyone who is like a true crime junkie probably already knows what Forensic Files is and is blasted through the entire anthology. But for anyone unaware of Forensic Files who just needs more murder in their life, hard recommend from me.
It's like the true crime equivalent of what Taskmaster is to you. This is like the thing that you put on, and you know that there are so many seasons of this that I can't possibly get through them all. And then, like, 4 days later, somehow, you know, you're already at the end of the catalog.
Well, to be fair, British seasons are only, like, 6 episodes long. But yes, I very much would recommend for anyone in need of either more death or an easier time falling asleep. You could do a lot worse than Forensic Files. Dom, I know you already made this point earlier, but if all else fails for you, you definitely have a promising career as murder mystery narrator.
Oh, you know, I'm going to get in touch with Phoebe Judge and we'll make something happen.
All right. Well, we have, have we spent a long time here talking about true crime, but I think that just kind of goes back to the initial point that this is, for whatever reason, seemingly a very fascinating subject to a large number of people. And I also, we'll wrap this up by saying one element we've probably overlooked here over the course of this discussion as far as why it has become so popular is the simple fact that just being a detective is kind of fun, right?
I suppose, yeah.
I feel like that's people like piecing together all the puzzle pieces, and not only true crime, this is why mystery is largely why mystery and thrillers are successful and plenty of other works and genres. But I do think that is at least worth getting on the record here at the end of the podcast, is even beyond the specific subject matter. I do think that element of people being able to connect the dots is something that is very appealing to the average human, not just in the context of which TV shows they want to watch. But, you know, this is why I think, not to go on a huge rant here, why people are at least have a tendency to be very results oriented is because we want to start with what we saw play out and then work backwards to put the pieces together of why it ended up going that way. And I think that is at least something we should state after we spent an hour or so going through all of the like psychological reasons that humans just want to watch others kill those around them. There are some probably less complex and dark reasons that this sort of thing is appealing as well. But Dom, I think for now that will wrap us up here on True Crime. One other item on the agenda here, and we were in need of kind of a quick reality TV sort of secondary topic here. And thank you to Kyle Picard over in the Dom and Colin Facebook group, excuse me, and apologies to Kyle if I'm mispronouncing your last name, if it's not the Star Trek pronunciation, and I'm apologizing also on behalf of anyone else who has spent your entire life getting that wrong.
He's actually French, Colin. The D is silent.
Okay, I'll leave that pronunciation up to you, Dom. What we are back here to talk about today, and credit to Kyle for submitting this by saying, this would only really be an idea if you're really reaching for something and don't have anything good. But we're going to go with it anyway here right away. What is the best Survivor first names?
But we're going to go with it anyway. That is exactly why we are going with it. So good read there by Kyle. And if you have any other ideas in that brain of yours, please let us have them. We are dying to hear them.
Yes. Dom, Kyle is wondering, what are the best Survivor first names? And I will begin this conversation by saying that it wasn't until being asked this question that I did the math on the fact that not only do we now have two different Survivor winners named Natalie, which is certainly something that had crossed my mind before I had noted it, that, hey, now we have Survivor winners who share a first name, who are not, you know, Sandra has done it twice herself, and now Tony is on the board. Like, I'm not counting the Grover Clevelands here of Survivor who just do it non-consecutively. If you would like any indication of how little time I have spent thinking about both seasons 38 and 39, at no point did I clock in either case that now we have another Survivor winner who shares a name with a previous winner.
I can't say that had crossed my mind either. So I learn something new every day, apparently.
Okay, well, we have Natalie, Chris, and Tom. I'm counting Tom and Tommy as the same name as multi-time winners here. So I feel like those have got to be in contention at the very least for greatest Survivor name. And then also did the math on Natalie Tenorelli went very deep. Chrissy and Christina Cha came maybe not very close to winning, at least in one of their cases, but if we want to add some points to the Chris scoreboard, I am definitely willing to count them as well. And then on top of Tom Westman and Tommy Sheehan, Big Tom went very deep on both of the seasons that he played, and I've certainly said this before, but I definitely remember a 14-year-old Colin Stone or whatever doing the math and thinking in all sincerity, I guess, to myself that, like, well, Big Tom came in third place fourth place his first time and fifth place his second time. I guess that makes Big Tom the greatest Survivor player of all time. After the All-Star season, he has the best average finish. And that was like a sincere thought that I had. So for no other reason than going far both times, I think Big Tom should give some weight there to...
It reminds me of... I saw someone sincerely argue on a forum once that Jordan Lloyd and Dr. Will are equally as good at Big Brother because they both came first and then they both came fourth. Maybe that person was 14-year-old Colin. I don't know.
It sure could have been. Kyle also, in the post that he brought up, I think Natalie, Chris, and Tom have got to be in the discussion, and they have those various little subcategories that are potentially giving them some points there. But Kyle flags up a Goliath of an example here, perhaps the Goliath too, the literal Davids that have played Survivor, who from my memory outside of David Wright, I don't think have gone on to a ton of fanfare. Dave Sampson comes to mind, potentially dragging that average down, but the Goliaths there, Dom, how about this block of Sandra, Cassandra, Cass and Sundra, all at the very least making final three.
Yeah, that's a very good run. I guess my question would be, are we just looking at the peaks or also the valleys? Because I think it's very easy when, you know, maybe I'm proving my point here by forgetting exactly which other Chris's, other non-winning Chris's there have been.
Chris Noble, perhaps, dragging that down a bit, yeah.
Famously, yes. Like with Tom's, for example, is Tom Laidlaw, like the Canadian hockey guy, does he get in the mix? There have got to be, you know, other Natalies, other Toms I'm just forgetting because they didn't make a big name for themselves. And so even though they should be dragging the average down, they just don't really register in quite the same way.
So I'm with you on the idea that that could potentially count as some negative points, although I did not factor that into any of my equations as things stand right now. And I'm also with you that it seems like there must be other Natalies who have played Survivor, but besides Natalie Anderson and Natalie Tenorelli, we had Natalia on whatever season she was on, 37? She was on with Natalie Cole, so that would have been season 37. Because they had very and there is the other Natalie, of course, now. We have some other Natalies in the mix.
The other Natalie, of course, being
Natalie Cole, who I completely forgot and am humiliated about.
Yeah, thank you.
I was saying, who are the other Natalies? Well, we at least had Natalia, which is close, and I remember her because she was on a season with Natalie Cole, but I'm struggling to come up with any other Natalies.
I was going to say, some of our, what we would consider our closest friends in the Survivor podcasting universe would cancel their patronage on the spot if they heard you forgetting about Natalie Cole. So glad to see you quickly rectifying your mistake there. When we're talking about the Toms and or Tommies of it all, how do we feel about the spirit of the no more Lockie stipulation, no first names that are also last names or vice versa? How do we feel about the mixed bag, shall we say, of JT Thomas, Shamar Thomas, and fan favorite game changer Sierra Dawn Thomas?
I mean, I certainly think they are worth factoring into the equation, and whether that is a net positive or a net negative, both remains to be seen. And honestly, Dom, I can't really decide. Is adding in those three people a net positive or a net negative for the Tom camp?
Well, I guess you could say on the one hand, there's JT. On the other hand, there's Shamar. But there's also, on the one hand, there's JT. And then on the other hand, there's JT. So I don't know
JT
quite
again,
how you
slice and then
that.
JT. Right. Yeah, I will certainly be noting that for my scorecard when the final decision is to be made. I would say, then I guess by that logic, Dom, is Sonia Christopher counting against the Chris camp?
Well, she is now that you've reminded me.
Or counting for them. Hey, listen, Sonia is a plus as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of being an iconic part of Survivor history, it really doesn't get much better than being the first ever boot on Survivor.
Yeah, so another couple of names that I've at least was able to come up with, and big time...
Hold on. Potential game changer here. For the Chris's, are we discounting Drew and Alec Christie?
Man, so if we were playing No More Lockies here, this would be a very sticky situation. For the sake of this conversation, I think Drew and Alec Christie should be counted along with Christie Smith in a separate bin.
How about Krista Hasty, the one and only?
They're in the Krista Christie bin together. They're not. I'm going to say I'm ruling they are not in the Christopher Christina bin.
How do you feel about Christian Hubicki?
Oh man, I really should have put a lot more thought into these notes here. Preparing.
To be fair, the exact name Chris may have more ambiguity than literally every other name on this list. So we're not bearing the lead. We're getting the tough one out of the way right now.
And then Christina Kell, I hadn't thought about. I'm sure there are other Christinas that I've forgotten about. This is a disaster. This was horribly thought out.
Yeah, no more Lockies, no more lawyers. Yeah, no more Chris's, no more anything else. But yeah, when I was doing my brief, hurried research for this, I was looking up all the Chris's. I didn't know what even consider Chris's with a K. That's a whole new dimension I have to work in there.
Christine Shields Markowski. I'm going to miss 100 people over the course of this podcast.
You mentioned Christina Kell, the very next boot on Survivor, Krista Klump, of course. How could any of us forget?
All right, this whole Chris situation needs to be sorted out in like a separate podcast by itself. Like, how do you branch out all of the people who stem from this tree to, I guess, throw together several different tree-related metaphors there? Dom, I feel like probably not in the mix for greatest of all time, but worth the honorable mention tier at the very least. And this could potentially be some big time recency bias as well, but in terms of names that have made some deep runs, if not very recently, but over the years, how about Laurens? I feel like have been on quite a tear recently. Lauren Ashley Beck, Lauren O'Connell, Lauren Rimmer, doing some solid work there. And then more historically, I feel like Kellys, however you want to spell it. And then I'll also add Kellyn into this bucket as well. I feel like you got some deep runs in there as well. Not any wins that come to mind, but certainly some high finishes.
Would you count Angelina Keely as an honorary Kelly?
I'll give it to him, since I don't know that this is going to be making a push for the title. I will up the points there for that set of candidates, and very gladly include Angelina in there to get her on the honorable mention tier here as well.
And that's not even to mention Reed Kelly, who, you know, is a natural Kelly with a Y and everything that I think definitely deserves to be on the list.
Okay. And again, as with all of the other names that we've talked through to this point, I am setting the over-under at like 3.5 per instance that we are forgetting about and not bringing up here on this podcast that could potentially...
Let's quickly run down a definitive list of Survivor Kellys, and possibly ranking them would be a good desperation ploy for another podcast.
Kelly Sharbaugh comes to mind. I'm now.
Well, let's okay.
Purple Colin, Kelly and Kelly, the other Kelly. Sorry, give me the full list. I don't know why I keep jumping in here.
Well, will I give you the full list, or will you give me the full list, my friend? Because it's time to put you on the spot. See, does Colin know things? Let's find out. How many Kellys can you name? Name that Kelly.
Do I get to know the target number of Kellys?
Yes.
Let me begin by saying I do not like that Colin, what does he know? Does he know things? Could potentially become a recurring game. This is not, I am not casual, Anna. I am not subjecting myself to this voluntarily.
Hold up. Is Colin like an honorary Kelly? Is that even in the same kind of cinematic universe?
That I feel like we're probably stretching a bit on, although I would love to be in the same cinematic universe as Colleen.
Oh, I'm sure you would love to be in the same cinematic universe as Kelly Wentworth as well, but we don't need to...
You know what? I hadn't thought that one through. Yeah, I'm 100% in that same cinematic
don't
universe.
Don't need to get into all of that. No Collins on Survivor yet, at least not on a US Survivor.
Yeah, Adam's pretty solid batting average, one finals appearance for one.
Well, I suppose Jeremy Collins, doing your name a good service. But on the other hand, also Erin Collins from Survivor Thailand. And that's not to mention Katie Collins, your girl, Once Upon a Time.
To this day, what are you talking about, Once Upon a Time?
Well sure, I think she has a... she appears to have a thing for older men, apparently.
Dude,
so that may...
You have got to be kidding me with Katie Collins. How? How on earth?
If you say so, you and Ian Terry can commiserate together over the money left on the table there.
Yeah, I don't mean I literally was in there. If we had ever interacted and she had ever known who I was, I at least feel like I could have put in a bid there. Dom, we have definitely skipped over potentially one juggernaut name here, really kind of being literally put on the back of both Rob Cesternino and Rob Mariano, literally putting the name. All right, I very much messed that up and then did them in the wrong order to try to make the reference. But
and also we are skipping over the Kelly name game here. So
That's right. You're right.
So before I name and shame you for skipping that game, let's see how many Kellys you can in fact name.
Okay, well let me just because then we're going to skip over the Rob thing. I think Rob Mariano and Rob Cesternino are doing a lot to carry the Rob name just
they
by
sure
themselves.
Are. Let's focus on the main event here.
Okay, are you going to give? I'm sorry if I was already told the target number and forgot.
So let me do a quick count. So oh god, there are a lot of them.
That's not what I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear like six.
Oh, and I'm having to delete from my count the returning players. So How many times has Kelly Wentworth been on? Jesus. So I believe our total count is 14 Kellys. But we,
oh, my God. All right. So number one, Kelly Wigglesworth.
Correct.
And it's only – it doesn't matter how many times they've played. It's
– a group – yeah. So okay. However many times, that is one Kelly.
Okay. You thought you were going to trip me up here. Number two, Kelly Goldsmith, Africa.
Did I think I was going to show
you? I could see it in your eyes, Dom, on this non-video podcast.
Okay.
Yes. And at this point, I think I'm going to forgo doing this chronologically. I just wanted to make sure I got the OGs out of the way. Let's knock off Purple Kelly and the other Kelly from Nicaragua.
Who, do you happen to know anything about that Kelly?
Not her last name.
No, any, distinguishing features.
What are you getting? Why do this?
Why not do this?
Because that is not something we need to harp on. That is something that happens to be the case. But anyway, I will then now take off the board here. Kelly Wentworth has already been mentioned enough, but I definitely don't want this to end in me somehow.
She though? Has she?
I will go for Kelly Sharbaugh, Kelly Kim. And that puts, I am counting seven. Do I have seven remaining?
You have seven Kellys on the board, and by my count, seven remaining. I'll confirm that quickly.
Okay. So now is where, so this is the annoying thing, is I know we've already talked through other Kellys, and I may literally have them written down in front of me here. And this is, this doesn't include Reed Kelly?
Correct.
Okay. A lot of Kellys here. A lot left on the board. I'm just stalling for a little bit to give the listeners some time to come up with their own names here. And now I honestly think I have to start going back through chronologically to make my way through this. I will probably end up cutting out a large amount of the deliberation here, but I feel like, okay, Kelly Joe Remington, let's not forget about potentially the merge boot that we had recently talked about in some podcast as one of the more prone to be forgotten. So that is eight off the board.
Hold on. Did you say Kelly Joe Remington?
Isn't that right?
Are you like merging together her and Wendy Joe from
No, I believe, while Wikipedia may not say this, I believe it was Kelly Joe Remington, and that I think that is accurate.
I mean, if that's the case, I'm very impressed that you managed to get that one.
Me too, honestly. So humiliated, though, that I have not been able to come up with these six other Kellys, right, who are sitting out there. Let's go. I mean, how many of these are going to be just early boots that have, in recent seasons, slipped my memory, if any of those, like, this is what I'm struggling with here, Dom, is I feel very confident that if I were not forced to talk through and not leave dead air, that I could do this very quickly, but it's difficult to roll through 600 Survivor contestants while also providing a live dialogue. Well, so if you could do some vamping here and give me some time to think, that would be fantastic.
I have some good news for you. Okay, so first of all, if we are including Kellen Bechtold, who I'm going to give you for free, then the count is, in fact, 11 Kellys that you need to get. And you have, I think, only two left on the board.
Okay, so I've
done eight. So you've done eight, and I gave you Kellen. So that's nine, and you only have two more. That feels pretty attainable.
Okay, and giving me Kellen when Kellen was not mentioned as on the board in the first place, I guess I'll count it as 9 out of 11 sounds better than 8 out of 10. But if there are only 10 career Kellys, I now feel a lot better about myself that I was able to get 8 relatively quickly. Although, I definitely want to be able to get all 10. The problem is, I don't want to be sitting here just hemming and hawing forever. So
should I put you out of your misery?
No, I want to have the remainder of the podcast to have them come to me as soon as I stop trying to think about it, and obviously I'm not going to look them up. That would very much defeat the purpose of this, so let me just throw into the end of the notes here that we need to check back in on the Kellys, and if I don't come up with the other two, then you can give us the answers there.
I did not include her on my list here, but does Christina Kell count as both a Chris and also a Kelly?
Double dipping there, I think a very worthwhile observation, Dom. And while we put the Kellys on the back burner there, already talked through Rob's potentially being in... also, Bob Crowley, throwing in... He's carrying his weight for Team Rob slash Robert slash Bob there. How about this kind of...
Rob Zabaknik, the general, who, I don't think, firstly, most people remember the general at all, but also don't remember him as a Rob, but he surely is. And then this would be another great game, name those Robs. Does Heidi Schroble count when she has Rob like wedged in the middle there?
Cliff Robinson?
Burton Roberts. I mean, Burton, he's not just one Rob. He is several Roberts. So I feel like he, by himself.
Double points. Plural Robs. Yeah.
On Robert, maybe. It's like half of a hyphenated name, but I think he's still in the mix.
Yeah, he's worth considering. I don't know how much he's bringing to the squad in terms of boosting their candidacy here, but worth getting his name out there as well. Dom, one kind of under the radar name candidate that I certainly don't think is in greatest of all time contention, but probably would have been overlooked if I, for whatever reason, had not had this happen to spark in my brain while I was preparing this podcast. How about Judd? Whether it's J-U-D, like Fabio's actual name, or Judd, J-U-double-D, like the guy from Guatemala. Judd, unless I'm forgetting any other Judds, seems like it does have a pretty solid batting average.
Well, speaking of guys from Guatemala, give me Rafe Judkins.
Mm. How about it? Yeah, hey, Judd getting stronger and stronger every time.
Who, I guess, I'm forgetting about Fabio here, but easily the second most successful Judd in the history of Survivor.
Yeah, hey, he's got that going for him. On the flip side of the coin here, Dom, if your name is Francesca, don't go on Survivor, I would say. Like, the fact that they're casting so many fans, I feel like there is legit meme value in voting out first anyone named Francesca.
What if there was a season that was Franz versus favorites, where it was a bunch of like C-list Survivor alumni from throughout Survivor history, and there's a whole tribe of Franz where, in theory at least, one of them should make a deep run?
It seems like it would be difficult for one of them not to go pretty far, but I would steer clear of Survivor altogether if my name were Francesca, just me. And then, in thinking through it, it seems like the Johns have not had Survivor go there. I'm sure, you know, John Cochran has gone on to be a Survivor winner, but he was very smart to just immediately shed the John the second he got out there and just go by Cochran the whole time. Dom, we have John Raymond was a first boot. John Rocker got blindsided with an idol pre-merge. John Fincher went pretty far, but it didn't really seem like anyone on either tribe ever really wanted to play with him at any point, although certainly got the last laugh there as far as I'm concerned at this point now, being married to Parvati. Johnny Fairplay was a first boot at one point, and then I'm sure I'm overlooking others, but it seems like the Johns have gotten their comeuppance quite a bit.
We've got John Hennigan, who a good, almost like an anti-villain in a way, where like you kind of know his downfall is coming and you want to see it coming, but you actually like him and are charmed by him enough that you kind of feel sad for him when it does. And there are some other Johns who are less memorable. I think at least one John on that Vanuatu Himbo tribe, right?
I believe there was a John K and a John P on that tribe.
And speaking of JPs, we've got JP Calderon, the hot one from Cook Islands, lots of random Johns. And then if you open the door to Johnsons, then the floodgates are open.
Yeah, that, at that point, what conversation are you even having? Although, if you want to throw the Jacks in there.
Let me tell you, the conversation that we're having is, can you remember all of the Johnsons?
No, I sure can. that one, we're not even attempting.
Did you mention John Cody, the heartthrob himself?
Oh, I mean, John Cody, doing a lot to bring up the John batting average there, I would say, even though he himself was a pre-merge boot on Survivor. Being a pre-merge boot on Survivor who's a doctor married to a hot other doctor is going to gain your team some points.
Hard to draw it up any better than that. Yeah. But as you mentioned, there is a whole nother class of Johns who need to be on the table here, and that's the Jacks, who I don't think we have that many of. I know there's only the Island of the Idols one that somehow is now dating the Olympian from his season. But they, I guess, technically in the mix, although I always kind of assumed that was a British thing, where Johns and Jacks were the same. I didn't know that was universal.
What, you didn't know that Jack was a nickname for John in other countries?
No.
You thought that, that they only did that in England, but the Jacks in America were literally named Jack?
Yes. This is my equivalent of you asking me, do they do that in England? I'm flipping the script on that. I'm assuming the things we do in England, nowhere else does now.
So when you were growing up, did you think that, like, people named Thomas in England were called Tom, but... I guess that's not really a fair example because it sounds more similar.
you tried to mock me and it blew up.
Did you grow up
thinking
that William and Bill were separate names in America but a nickname in England?
I didn't grow up thinking anything, okay? I didn't think as a child, and that got me into a lot of trouble.
I am going insane, by the way, trying to come up with these other two Kellys. So congratulations to all of the other listeners.
The madness is showing.
Can you at least tell me, are either of them super obvious? Like, I'm going to feel dumb when I don't get them?
Oh, you're going to feel dumb when you don't get them.
Oh, God.
Whether or not they're obvious is, you know, another question.
This is annoying. All right, anyway.
I invite all the listeners playing along at home who surely have got the identity of those final two Kellys by now to bask in the glow of smug satisfaction at knowing something that Colin doesn't.
Okay, the only other name I wanted to add on to the, maybe not the highest Survivor batting average as far as how well received this name is. We had one guy named Russell go on Survivor and almost die his first time and then kind of flop his second time and be eliminated pre-merge. And then the other Russell is Russell Hance. So I would guess that Russell may be a name that could use some positive representation out there. Although Russell Swan in real life does seem a lot better from what I have seen than he did on Survivor.
Major chaotic energy to Russell's on Survivor.
Yes. And then one thing that is not going to be a factor here is I've always been fascinated by the most popular names that have never appeared on Survivor. So for instance, like, I think it's still the case that no one named Emily has ever played Survivor, right? At least in America.
Yeah, that's right. And in my research for this, and I assume you kind of did the same thing, I was looking at the most popular names from like the mid 1990s, where, you know, you're in your mid 20s, that feels like a good age to end up on Survivor. Emily was the most popular name for girls at that point. Michael was the most popular name for boys, and we have had so many Michaels on Survivor that, again, if I asked you to list them all, you would be here all day. Emily's, surprisingly, we have had none of on the show so far.
Yeah, have there been Samanthas on Survivor?
Definitely on Australian Survivor, the one who was in that brief showmance with one of the many, many Marks who have graced our screens across the years. I don't think there has been on the US version.
Have there been Justins besides Jay Sterrett, whose name is Justin, but he went by Jay?
Have we had any Justines, even?
No, and nor would I expect us to have Justines, because the only person I can even think of named Justine is Justine Bateman. That's not a very common name in America.
Justine Littlewood, for any of the Tracy Beaker fans out there. I can't think of any Justins.
Yeah, I mean, a fair follow-up question, but Justine, I would say, not really in the same pantheon of ridiculousness that it hasn't come up at any point. And I mean, Jay Sterrett does obviously count as technically a Justin, but it's wild that no one has ever written the name Justin down on a piece of paper.
So I'm looking at this list here quickly, which is tracking the most popular names by year, and every single name on the top, every single name on this top five list, other than Samantha and Emily, for both men and women, we have had many, many examples of. And as the names change over time, it's like, okay, In 1996, Emily was the most popular name for girls, while Michael was still the top pick for boys. 1997, Michael and Emily took the first slots in the popularity contest. 1998, Emily was once again the leading name. Michael was the most popular baby name of either gender. From 1955 to 1998, so a wide gap there. 1999, Jacob took over the number one spot for boys in 1999, with Michael sliding down to number two. Emily remained the favorite for the girls. And then 2000, you can see the sense of frustration seeping into the commentary here. At the beginning of the new millennium, the most popular baby names were still Jacob and Emily. And then it just continues. 2001, Jacob and Emily. 2002, Emily and Jacob held the first spot, but girl names like Madison and Hannah were not too far behind. And so 2003, Emily's and Jacob's continue their supremacy. 2004, Emily was consistently popular into the 2000s. So I love how every year they have to find a new phrase to put a spin on Emily, still just by far being the Serena Williams of the girl's name heavyweight class.
And here we are, had, you know, 20 plus years of Survivor, still zero. I guess Christian Hubicki's girlfriend slash fiance slash wife. I'm not sure where things stand at this point, but she's, I'm pretty confident, named Emily, and she at least made an appearance at the loved ones visit. And probably some other Emilys have been out there in that context as well, but that is wild. And then have we had a Kyle on Survivor? Am I forgetting about Kyle's? Kyle Jason. How about that?
I was just about to jump in, but yeah, I think he, what did he go by on the show again? It was just Jason, right?
He went by Jason. Yeah.
I seem to remember him having some kind of nickname. But yeah, I think he's Sarge. The only one. Oh, Sarge, of course.
Yeah, but on the actual show, I don't think they ever really called him Kyle. He just went by Jason, which is, hey, he's with you, Dom, in the first name for a last name club.
Mm-hmm.
Good company. Man, so I think I may have one of these other Kellys, but let me just roll back through... And this is probably just going to get me further away from the final answer. So we have Kelly Wigglesworth, Kelly Goldsmith, Purple Kelly, Other Kelly from Nicaragua, Kelly Wentworth, Kelly Sharbaugh, Kelly Joe Remington. And of course, now I've forgotten the eighth one that I had already gotten to this point. But
Kelly
I still...
Kim.
Kelly Kim. Thank you. I believe.
And by the way, no sign of a Joe in Kelly Remington's name. So I think you did.
I may have completely...
I'll give it to you. And then Kellen Bechtold, bringing up the rear for the Kellys who are floating within Colin's object permanence.
Okay, I believe, man, there was definitely a blonde girl on Gabon named Jackie, but I want to say there was a Kelly on Gabon as well.
Correct.
Okay,
yes.
There's one of them.
Bonus points if you can pronounce her last name.
No chance. Okay. I couldn't even hazard a guess.
All right, so let's there is one Kelly.
What's your pronunciation of her last name?
I want to say Czarnecki, something like that.
Oh, Czarnecki would probably be.
Czarnecki, sure.
And then one other Kelly. I'm trying to go through season by season, but making very little progress along those lines. That's how I got to Gabon, but I don't know if I've missed it on the front, on the seasons leading up to Gabon. Or the seasons.
I'll give you a hint. You have missed it on your foraging.
On my way to. So now I feel a lot worse about this. So let's see. There was definitely not another Kelly in season one. No Kellys coming to mind in season two. Kelly Goldsmith already in season three. Don't think there was a Kelly on season four. Don't think there was a Kelly on season five or six or seven. Don't think there was a Kelly on. Is this a girl Kelly? Is there some guy named Kelly that I'm forgetting about?
I'm not offering you any further hints.
Okay, man. Is it John Kelly? Is that
what is there a John? No.
Okay,
not
John.
Him.
John it's Kelly was a guy from Vanuatu. I'm sorry that this is probably the least enthralling podcasting we've done in quite some time, as everyone else has been sitting there with the correct answer.
well, it's going to be very enthralling, because when you finally get it, or when I reveal it to you, you will fly into the aforementioned murderous rage.
Oh no! Oh god! Now this is so much worse. I mean, now there is absolutely no winning here because I've already taken beyond an acceptable amount of time for any Kelly, but certainly a Kelly that should stand out. So let's really think this through. There are definitely no other Kellys on season one. I cannot come up with any other Kellys on season two. I am going to say Kelly Goldsmith was the only one on season three, because I think I remember the two Kims on season three being the first two people to share a name on the same season. I then don't believe there were Kellys on season four, although I could potentially be forgetting about one there. Could also definitely be forgetting about a random Kelly on season five or six, but I don't think there was a Kelly on season six. I'm pretty confident there was not a Kelly on Pearl Islands. There were two Ryans on Pearl Islands, and I feel like I would remember if there were multiple people who shared a name together. All-Stars, unless I have missed a Kelly leading up to this point, I feel like All-Stars is pretty safe. I'm going to put this out there. Very nervous about Vanuatu. Very nervous about Palau. Somewhat nervous about Guatemala. Although, again, if this is someone I'm going to be flying into a murderous rage about, it's probably not Guatemala, right?
Wait, what? Why?
I guess it's Guatemala. I guess I'm kind of going, because like, no one who went deep into Guatemala. We just rewatched and podcast Guatemala. That no one who went deep into Guatemala.
Sure did.
Oh, come on. Now is it seriously about to be Guatemala?
No.
Okay.
Of course not.
Okay. God damn it. All right. Now it's definitely going to be Guatemala. I'm so sorry to all the podcast listeners who are having to subject themselves, and hopefully you guys have just tuned out by now or are just fast forwarding to the last few seconds of this episode where I murder Dom and that's the thing that gets us the HBO contract. Let me just complete my list of seasons that definitely do not feature Kelly before you rip the Band-Aid off here. I am not getting a Kelly from Guatemala. I am pretty confident there is not one in Exile Island, Cook Islands. All right, I am at the point where I have certainly taken far too much time and am very ready to have just overlooked one of the most glaring Kellys in Survivor history. Dom, I am frankly just not going to get there at this point in time, so let's hear it. Let's have the big reveal. Everyone gets to laugh at me now as Dom gets killed.
You sure have overlooked one of the most iconic figures in all of Survivor history. Let me give you Kel Gleeson from Survivor Australia.
Did you seriously just force me to do 20 minutes of talking through all of the Kellys from Survivor history and then hit me with Kel Gleeson?
Good night, everyone.